Tomorrow, our nation celebrates Independence Day. Happy 4th of July, everybody. Throughout this long weekend, many people will host or attend picnics and cookouts. People who keep statistics say that as a nation this weekend, we will consume 150 million hot dogs, 190 million pounds of beef or pork, 270 million pounds of chicken, not to mention the millions and millions of pounds of potato salad and baked beans and corn on the cob and chips and cookies and cupcakes. Doubtless, some fortunate dogs will also get a share of the meat that falls from the grill. And birds and mice and chipmunks and even ants will feast too on the crumbs that tumble to the ground. And households like mine will enjoy leftovers for days to come because we always prepare more than enough food. This impromptu picnic that Jesus hosts on a hillside in Galilee does not start off looking like a feast. In fact, the disciples are not sure how everyone's going to get enough to eat, let alone have leftovers. But Jesus sees a great teaching opportunity in this unexpected gathering. First, he quizzes Philip. How shall we feed all these people? Now, in John's gospel, Philip and Andrew are the first two disciples called, the first to name Jesus as Messiah, the first to describe him as the one the prophets wrote about. Despite those faith confessions of Jesus as Messiah, neither Philip nor Andrew can imagine a scenario where the 5,000 are fed. Jesus directs the crowd to sit down. Maybe it's so they can see what happens next. The young boy hands his 5 barley loaves and his 2 fish to Jesus. Now, barley bread is a flat, grainy bread like pita bread. A small loaf is an individual serving. It's not a loaf that's going to make a stack of sandwiches. Barley bread is a staple for the poor. Barley flour costing less than wheat flour. And those 2 fish were probably sardines produced by the fisheries in Magdala along the Sea of Galilee. The men and women, for surely there were women present, see this impoverished child willingly give his lunch to the teacher, and the teacher lifts it toward heaven and gives thanks for the gift, and as he does, a miracle occurs. Now, a biblical literalist will say that the food multiplied mysteriously because God made it happen. And a biblical interpreter will suggest the miracle came when 5,000 people saw one child share his lunch and this gathering of overwhelmingly poor persons opened their satchels and shared what they had with their neighbors as well. And the miracle was the generosity. Whichever way you view this miracle, not only did everyone eat till they had enough, not only do I imagine there were crumbs enough to satisfy several dozen sparrows and squirrels and insects, but also there were leftovers. 12 baskets of leftovers. Gather those up, Jesus directs his disciples. Let nothing be wasted. Wasted or lost or perish. The Greek verb used here for wasted is the same Greek verb gospel writer John employs in chapter 3 when Jesus says to Nicodemus, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Not one soul should be wasted, nor should one crumb." God is the original conservationist. Gathering up the leftovers tells us that the broken bits, even the broken bits, can still serve to feed and to nourish. We don't know from the text what happens to those baskets of broken bits. Did they become breakfast for Jesus and his disciples the next day? Were they distributed to the poor who live in the next village they travel to? We don't know. But we know that the broken bits matter to Jesus. Recycling, reusing, repurposing, redistributing, conserving, call it what you will. The act of gathering up the leftovers so that nothing is lost matters to Jesus, and so it should matter to us. Novelist, poet, environmental activist Wendell Berry says, "The care of the earth is our most ancient and worthy, and after all, our most pleasing responsibility. To cherish what remains of it and to foster its renewal is our only hope." The prophet Isaiah lived in a day of little hope, and he used the adjectives gaunt, gray, silent, sad, lifeless, colorless, polluted, disrupted in describing the broken world he knew, the way he viewed the failings of humankind and their separation from God. But when he envisioned the world restored, he described the beauty and harmony of a peaceable kingdom where the wolf will live with the lamb, and the leopard lie down with the goat, and the calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child shall lead them. And the cow will feed with the bear, their young lie down together, the lion eats straw like the ox. The infant will play near the cobra's den, the young child put its hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Isaiah believed the restoration of the whole of creation came with knowing God. And we see a glimpse of God in Jesus, who directed his followers to gather up those leftovers and let nothing go to waste. In John's gospel, shortly after this mountainside moment with the disciples and the crowd, Jesus will tell his disciples, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry. Whoever believes in me will never be thirsty." In context, alongside this miraculous story about an impromptu picnic, what if Jesus is not just telling them not to waste food, but also not to waste him, not to waste his word, not to waste his wisdom, the bread of heaven that gives life to the world, not to waste the love of God that is poured out abundantly to them and to the world through him? The greatest commandments, Jesus tells us, are to love God and to love your fellow creations. United Church of Christ pastor Kenneth McIntosh writes in his book, Water from an Ancient Well, "There are countless ways to get involved in efforts to restore the environment. Do all these as conscious acts of worship. Remind yourself that you are tending to God, tending to the very flesh of your Maker. We are to love the two-legged and the four-legged, the tall and the squat, the swimmers and the creepers and the flyers and the stalkers. To love the greens and yellows and reds and golds and blues and purples, the deserts and the rainforests, the sunrises and the sunsets. Love the rocks and sands and mountains and beaches. Love and cherish and nurture it all." And this week, it feels like the creation needs all the love we can pour out on it. The creator of this worship series, United Methodist pastor Corey Turnpenny, says, "The whole creation is waiting for us to let go of our selfish ways and begin acting like the children of God. It's waiting for us to hold in our hearts a vision of an interconnected world and to remember that every part of this planet tells of God's goodness. It's waiting for us to see the sacred worth of the elements, the flora, the fauna, to live gently as stewards and protectors." The Talmud, the set of teachings and commentaries from Jewish law that accompany the Hebrew scriptures, says, "Do not be daunted by the enormity of the world's grief. Do justly now. Love mercy now. Walk humbly now. You're not obligated to complete the work, but neither are you free to abandon it." As daunting as it seems, as large the work of creation care may loom, you and I have the opportunity to care for the earth right here where we are. So plant trees and nurture gardens and conserve water. Look for all the ways you can reduce your carbon footprint. recycle more and use less. At home, at work, here at church, in the community, for the sake of our neighbors, for the sake of God's world. Amen.